Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Throughout history, religious organizations have been the source of much-needed community support. From helping the needy to providing for orphans and the elderly, churches, as well as mosques and synagogues, have provided social welfare services to their members and to society at large. Over the past century, however, many of these tasks have been taken over by secular governments. How has the creation and growth of the modern welfare state affected the role of religious groups? Have churches found themselves in competition with secular welfare providers? And have they been pushed out of the arena of social welfare provision? Also, is there a crowding out effect between increased taxation for government-sponsored social services and charitable contributions to religious groups? In other words, if taxes go up, do charitable contributions go down? And what about other sources of competition for churches? Does the elimination of blue laws, laws that required businesses to close on Sundays, affect church attendance? Or in other words, if the shopping mall is now open, will there be fewer people in the pews? To answer these questions, I am joined today by Daniel Hungerman, assistant professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame and faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Dan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin by complimenting you as being one of the best young economists doing work in the area of religious economics now. We could maybe give you the Stephen Levitt Award for religious economics. For those listeners who are not familiar with this area of research, what the economics of religion field does is to use some of the basic concepts and theories associated with economics and primarily microeconomics to understand how individuals and organizations such as churches, behave with respect to one another. And for the most part, scholars in this new area have really tended to keep religious behavior confined to the religious realm. For instance, one theme in the economics of religion has been that churches compete with other churches for members. So we see a marketplace of churches, and we subscribe, I guess, proscribe the marketplace of religions just to religions. But Dan, I think your contribution to this field is really that you think about the arena of competition as being much larger than that. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of work by economists studying religion is focused on, you know, churches competing with one another. So you take a look at a congregation, or more commonly even a church, and you try to see how that church's decisions and outcomes are affected by the church across the street. But in a lot of my work, I say, let's not just look at the church across the street. Let's look at the shopping mall across the street, the football stadium across the street, the government across the street, and let's see how those organizations might impact what's going on inside of congregations.
Yeah, it seems somewhat natural. I mean, one of the things about economics is that it's the study of decision-making under scarce resources, and given that we only have 24 hours of the day, you know, it's not surprising to see that people do other things than go to church, right? We have to feed ourselves. We need to entertain ourselves and such. So, you know, these things most naturally would seem to impinge upon, you know, our church-going activities and other things that we do within the religious realm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And increasingly so, I would say. Some scholars might disagree with me on that. But that's right. We have to do these other things. And so a lot of my work tries to look at the relationship between religious activities and secular activities.
Yeah, let's talk about some of these secular activities. And one of the things that I'm interested in is religion and politics. So let's kind of start off with the government realm of things here. And one of the things that caught my eye about your research a while back was the competition between religious organizations and government that you write quite a bit about. In a paper that you wrote entitled Faith-Based Charity and Crowd Out During the Great Depression, you, along with your co-author Jonathan Gruber, start with the claim that churches have traditionally been the main provider for welfare services in the community. And this is before the 1930s here. So talk to us a little bit about prior to the 1930s and then what happens during the Great Depression and the subsequent New Deal.
Sure. Although before I start, I should probably point out that you yourself have also done some good work kind of discussing the relationship between churches and government. So, you know, I'm not alone in looking at this important area.
I have to note that I did chastise Dan a little bit about, you know, in that paper, and we'll have that paper linked on our website as well as a number of his other papers. Like, I look for my citation there, and scholars love to see themselves cited in print. And lo and behold, I was not there. So I had to chastise Dan. So he's giving me my proper due here. So
that's right, on the radio anyway. But yeah, I'll have to keep that in mind if I do more work in this area.
No problem. I like kidding with folks about that. So, all right. So tell us about what goes on in the 1930s or what was happening before the 1930s.
Yeah. Back in colonial times, going back before the 1930s, faith-based charity wasn't super important. But then after the Revolutionary War, especially when we started to get an influx of immigration into this country in a few different waves in the 1800s and early 1900s, faith-based charity, or just religious organizations providing social services, became very important in the United States. So much so that in the decade before the Great Depression, in the 1920s, congregations spent about seven times as much on services for the disadvantaged as did state governments, for example, about five times as much as local governments. So, and you know, at that time, the federal government spent almost nothing.
Right.
So, they were a much more important and dominant player. They weren't the only player, but they were a much more important player in helping out the disadvantaged than we see today.
And it's something really to draw attention to, because we don't, you know, living in the 21st century today, and many of us have lived in the 20th century as well, we don't even think that religions would play that much of a role. I mean, for us, you know, being born after the 1950s, it's, you know, the government has always been there to provide social welfare services. So when you cite these statistics that, you know, religious organizations or charities provide seven times as much as state governments and five times as much as the local governments do, that's astounding.
Yeah, they're big numbers. And there have been some individuals. There's one guy named Marvin Olasky who coined the term compassionate conservative, I believe, a phrase that was kind of big back when Bush first ran for office in the late 1990s, who's argued that not only do churches play a bigger role, but that the quality of the social services they provided were different than the sort of services you get from the government. And, you know, some people, Olasky perhaps as an example, might argue that in some situations, churches can provide services in ways that are superior to those of the government.
Mm-hmm. And so, in what ways? I mean, what kind of services is he arguing that are provided differently than governments do?
Well, you know, a lot of these services are, again, ones that might not necessarily seem so different from what the government's doing. So employment services, not necessarily medical services the way that, like, Medicare and Medicaid provide them, but things like hospital visitations, or working with government medical institutions or correctional institutions, as well as things that we might typically associate with religious organizations, things like advocating certain social causes or educational services, mm-hmm. things like that. There is work, and I'm not just saying this because I teach at a Catholic institution, but there's work even today looking at Catholic high schools that suggests that students who go to Catholic schools do better than students who go to public schools.
Yeah, education is one of those big social services that we oftentimes forget about when we talk about welfare services. But, you know, as you mentioned, the waves of immigration, people coming over in, you know, the various parts of the 1800s. I mean, the Catholic Church was there oftentimes trying to provide schools and other type assistance for a lot of these ethnic communities that get off the boat and they say, hey, strange land, what do I do now?
That's right. Although, as we discuss in this New Deal paper, where we look at how the rise of New Deal spending, kind of the introduction of federal support for the disadvantaged, affected faith-based support for the disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
a quality difference is one way in which the government's different from what churches were doing. But there are some other important differences also that became clear during the Great Depression for how governments can provide services relative to churches.
Well, go ahead and tell me about that. What happens in the 1930s with the New Deal? We're talking, you know, Great Depression, you're roughly dated from the 1929 stock market crash, tends to get a little bit worse in the 1930s, unemployment reaching up to 20% or more. So where does the government step in, and how does this relate to religious organizations?
So a lot of the big ramp up of government services that we're talking about in our paper on the New Deal, John Gruber and I, are services that kind of crank up in 1933. So these are kind of the classic New Deal programs. So Civil Works Administration, or CWA, the Works Progress, or Projects, it changed its name, Administration, WPA, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, FERA. A lot of these are the classic kind of New Deal programs for the poor. And a lot of these programs are forerunners of programs that go under different names today, like TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, programs like AFDC, which isn't around anymore, kind of classic welfare programs.
Mm-hmm. And so in your this introduced under FDR, part of the New Deal, and starting in 1933, what kind of effect do you see happening with what churches were doing?
It's pretty interesting. What we see is that for the first few years of the Great Depression, which some scholars would say were the worst years, from 1929 to 33, we see churches doing a lot with the resources they had. Charitable church spending in the local community, at least as a fraction of the income of church members, is pretty high those first few years in the Depression. But then in 1933, when these New Deal programs show up, there's a sudden steep drop in spending by congregations to aid those in their community. And it stays down throughout most of the 1930s after that.
Now, to what extent is this an effect of government policy, or is it just, you know, one could plausibly argue that, well, you know, churches were going gangbusters during, you know, 1930, 31. They just basically ran out of resources at this point in time because the recession, depression was so long.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's actually right where our paper comes in, because that's a very common question. That's the whole point of our paper is to get at that exact issue. Was this rise in New Deal spending causing churches to do less? Or was it just that, you know, the New Deal is coming along because everybody's going broke, and since everybody's going broke, churches are running out of money? So in our paper, we try to do a few clever things to separate those two stories. And what we find is that, in fact, the increase in New Deal spending does seem to cause a decline in church spending in the community. It isn't just a story where everyone's running out of money.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the title of the paper, you call this the crowd out or a crowding out effect.
Right.
And that's an economic term. What is crowding out, or what is the crowd out effect?
Yeah, fortunately, as economic terms go, this one's actually, you know, pretty sensible. Simply, a crowd out effect means if the government spends one more dollar on something, how large of a reduction in spending do you see from non-government sources? So here we're looking at, you know, for every extra dollar of government New Deal spending, how much of a decline do you get in faith-based charitable spending for the poor? You know, does a dollar of New Deal spending crowd out, so to speak, a dollar of faith-based spending, or is it, you know, some smaller number?
What kind of quantitative magnitude, or what's the effect here that you see?
The effect that we see at first doesn't sound too big. We find that New Deal spending crowded out a few cents on the dollar. So for every dollar increase in New Deal spending, you get a few cents, 5 cents, 10 cents, of a drop in church spending.
Mm-hmm.
However, the New Deal was enormous. It was just absolutely gigantic. And so when you add up all those dollars in New Deal spending, you get a pretty large decline in faith-based charity as a result.
In just terms of the dollar amounts, right? So you have a 5% change, but if the government is, you know, really ramping up the spending, it's that 5% can be a huge number nonetheless, right?
That's right. And you know, going back to our earlier discussion of, you know, how faith-based charity might compare with government charity, a difference in scope is also something to keep in mind. What the government was doing here was much bigger than what faith-based organizations were able to do. And, you know, in an economic crisis like the Great Depression, you know, that difference in scope, I think, was something that's really important. And it's something to keep in mind when people, like Marvin Alasky, who we were talking about earlier, want to make comparisons between faith-based charity and government charity.
Yeah, I think that's something we're going to maybe talk a little bit about later on when we kind of bring it up to date here. But in terms of the distribution of charity, one of the interesting points that you talked about in your church or your paper mm-hmm. was the difference between how churches allocated resources versus how the government allocated resources at this time. One of the things that you had talked about was, religious charities pretty much opened the door to, you know, first their own religious community, but then broadly to the community at large. But and how was that a little bit different than what the government did?
So hopefully the government did some of that also. But something that we discussed quite a bit in the paper is that some New Deal spending, at least in part, seems to be politically driven. And I won't get into the complex details, but it's that fact that some New Deal spending seems motivated by political concerns rather than economic concerns. That's what allows us to distinguish between a story where New Deal spending causes a drop in church spending versus everybody's, you know, going broke. And, you know, as everybody goes broke, the New Deal shows up and churches run out of money. We're able to separate those two stories that I'd been talking about a few minutes ago by looking at the political incentives that made a large impact on how New Deal spending was allocated across states.
In part, this is what political economists would call political rent-seeking, in that, you know, there's a big, huge pot of money that's controlled by the government here, and, you know, those who control that pot of money can extract different favors or resources from specific individuals who would like to get their hands on that pot of money. And you mentioned a congressman, I think it was James Buchanan, not the presidential Buchanan, but one who was a congressional representative or senator from Texas, I believe.
That's right, a representative and a very influential one. He headed the Appropriations Committee, a very important committee back then, and yeah, he was a very influential guy. In fact, the nation's first Social Security office was opened in his hometown, I believe back in Texas, after he made some threats to cut the Social Security budget. And, you know, he didn't actually cut it. Instead, he got this nice office with some, you know, extra jobs, back in his hometown. So, you know, one of the stories we talk about in the paper is that, after Buchanan did all of this good finagling to get some good economic stimulus back in his hometown, in 1937, he unexpectedly died of a heart attack. And curiously enough, both the chairman before and after him on the Appropriations Committee also died in office. So this is a pretty stressful place to, have a job, I think, the Appropriations Committee back in the Great Depression. But after Buchanan died, in the data, you can see a sudden drop in the amount of New Deal spending flowing into Buchanan's home state. So, yeah, you know, it's kind of a good anecdotal example to illustrate how politics did play, at least to some extent, a role in New Deal spending.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent, I mean, I don't know if you looked into this, but to what extent did the churches do that? I mean, I mentioned at the outset here that it seems churches tend to give a little bit more altruistically, and they don't care who you are when you walk into the soup kitchen or such. But, I mean, mm-hmm. is that the general impression that you have?
That's a tougher question. And my answer to that is, back then, I'm not sure, to be honest. Looking at the evidence today, I think there at least is some evidence that churches, either intentionally or maybe unintentionally, also sometimes play favorites mm-hmm. when providing services For example, there's been some work by myself and I think a few other people which have shown that if you look at the racial composition of a church and you look at the racial composition of, you know, those in a community who are in need of support, churches are going to be more likely to provide support when those who are in need are of the same racial group. And, you know, that isn't necessarily a story about overt racism. It could just be a story, for example, where, you know, if those in your community who are in need are of a, you know, are of a different racial group, maybe you just aren't as aware of their hardship. Maybe it's more difficult for you to learn about the right ways to provide services for them, you know, things like that. So I do think that there are ways in which churches might sometimes struggle to provide services in as indiscriminate a way as they might like.
Mm-hmm. Let me, we're going to come back to that topic because you wrote another paper on that about the diversity impact of neighborhoods on policies. And but I still want to focus a little bit here, you know, going back to the 1930s and the New Deal era. And, you know, as you know, your paper really deals with a lot of quantitative tests of these things. But I just trying to think through the, you know, the logic of this. What do you think is going on in terms of this crowding out effect? Do churches, you know, all of a sudden see that, you know, in comes the New Deal bureaucrats and they start providing these services and they said, oh, you know, that we don't have to do that anymore? Or is there something else going on? What is the causal mechanism that's at play there?
The causal mechanism. You know, the causal mechanism might in part be demand driven. So if you need help this week to make it, or, you know, help this month to pay the bills, to put something on the table, whose door are you going to knock on? And, you know, when the New Deal began, there was not just a lot of money that the government was providing to help those who were in need, but there was to some extent institutional changes in the ways in which services were being provided, you know, starting with the fact that the federal government was playing a role, sometimes through the states, but sometimes changing the ways that states did things. And so there might be new places for people to knock on the door that they didn't have before. And so to some extent, it could be just churches perceiving some, you know, saying, oh, you know, now we, you know, have a government here to do these things. Let's, you know, buy a new organ or something. But it could also simply be that, you know, as the government shows up, people kind of redirect themselves. The people who are in need redirect themselves to the government, and so, you know, churches simply see less of a demand for those services that they used to provide.
And it's when somebody, you know, when the government opens a soup kitchen down the street and you don't have to go to the Catholic mission anymore, you just go to the government one. And, you know, I don't know to what extent that some people felt reluctant to go to some of these, you know, religious charities feeling that they might be pressured to become a member of the church or something. I don't know if that was in play or what.
It probably was in play to some extent. I mean, I think a lot of religious organizations consider that an important part of the social service. Whether or not you think that's a good thing, obviously, might depend upon whether you're the one providing those services or you're the one who's receiving those services.
Right.
Nowadays, you know, not to change the subject from the Great Depression or anything, but nowadays we have some government funds for faith-based charity, and that's a big deal with these more recent government efforts to fund faith-based charity.
Right.
Is the concern that you're going to get government-funded proselytizing. You know, I don't think that happens too much with government-funded faith-based charity, but certainly throughout history, yeah, some congregations view that as a key part of their service, that they're providing the disadvantage.
Yeah, and I should note that we just recently had a podcast with Jay Hine, who ran the Faith-Based Initiative Office in the White House, and so we'll provide a link for the that podcast up on the website so people can kind of cross-reference some of these here. So in terms of, you know, you went through and there's some very sophisticated econometric testing that you did of this and try to filter out this effect of whether it was, you know, the economy that was just wearing thin on some of these churches or whether there was this true crowding out effect that when the government comes in, churches get pushed out of this arena a little bit. Do you see, I mean, one of the other test that I could think of potentially here is what happens after the Great Depression. Do we see any charitable church rebound in the 1950s when we pull out of the Great Depression?
The 1950s, let me think for a second. We kind of we called it a day in that study in 1940, because once, you know, World War II shows up, we figured everything, you know, it's a whole different ball game. As for the 1950s, I'm going to be honest with you. Off the top of my head, I do not know a lot. I know a lot about church services for the poor at various parts of the 20th century. The 50s are one of those areas where I do not know a whole lot. I know that overall, lots of measures of religious participation are going up then.
Right. Right.
It's kind of a high watermark for a lot of measures of religious participation, in
That's
fact.
Right. Yep.
And it's also before we have some of the expansion of the federal government through the Great Society that we've had since then. Medicaid, for example, the Earned Income Tax Credit, another big example. Supplemental Security Income is another huge means-tested program, by which I mean a program for the poor. So all those things still hadn't happened in the 1950s. And so if I were to guess, I would guess that congregations were playing less of a role in social service provision than they played back before the Great Depression, but a larger role than they're playing today.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just an educated guess.
Well, those educated guesses are actually great dissertation topics for graduate students out there, or, you know, perhaps that could be your next paper. I mean, one of the things we like to do here on Research on Religion is not only are we broadcasting to a general lay audience, but we hope that a number of scholars and graduate students are listening to us. And, you know, we hope not only to answer some questions about things, but to raise new questions and, you know, prompt research agendas out there.
Well, maybe I should just say, if you're a graduate student listening to this and you're willing to work for free, give me a call.
There you go. Okay. I guess that's the way to do it. We're going to put your flag down on this one. And let's go ahead and move forward, because we just worked our way, I guess, through the Great Society. So we'll call the 1950s and 60s a black box here. And you wrote another really great paper. In fact, this one actually was a paper that you wrote earlier than the one on the Great Depression. The title of it was "Are Church and State Substitutes: Evidence from the 1996 Welfare Reform," and here in this paper, and the reason I like these two papers together is the situation is a bit reversed, because in the 1996 welfare reform, the government starts to reduce the amount of services provided to the traditional welfare constituencies. So, what is going on there in 1996?
96 was a very important year in the history of government provision for the poor. It saw a radical redesign of welfare services. You know, I'll spare you some of the details, unless, of course, you want to know them all.
No, let's hear some of the details. We got some time.
Yeah, well, one important thing was that traditional welfare, which before then had been known as AFDC and afterwards was known as TANF, which I brought up a little bit ago, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, that had been considered an entitlement program, one in which if you qualified and you were eligible, you got it. As a citizen of the United States, it was you were entitled. And now that is no longer true. States can kick you off that program after a little while if they want. That was very controversial. Another important and controversial aspect of that law, one that I focus on a lot in the paper, this is the key one from my research, is that it limited the availability of welfare services, not just traditional welfare, but also things like food stamps and, to some extent, Medicaid and Supplemental Security Income. It limited the availability of those programs for non-citizens. And that distinction between citizens and non-citizens was a controversial and very important part of that law. Subsequent to that law being passed, welfare use and the use of government programs for the poor in general by non-citizens went way down. In fact, it went so far down that researchers are actually a little surprised. Even certain non-citizen families who were still legally able to use these government programs, for example, because they had a kid in their household who was a citizen, even those eligible non-citizen households cut back dramatically on their use. of government services for the disadvantaged.
And now, you know, by playing out the thesis that you talked about a little bit earlier, that when the government steps in, you expect churches to get crowded out. Now, when the government is stepping out, and specific with these non-citizen communities, it would seem to open the door for churches to come back in.
That's right. So now we're looking at it the other way. Exactly.
Right.
So in this paper, that's kind of what I do. I say, let's look at churches, Presbyterian churches in particular, because that's what I had data on back when I was a graduate student. And let's look at their, you know, provision for poor individuals before and after this reform. Let's look at places where the legislative details of these reforms ensured a large reduction in welfare services after 1996. Mm-hmm. And let's see if right when the law was passed, churches in those communities suddenly crank up their support for the poor.
Mm-hmm. And what do we find?
We find that they do crank up their support for the poor. And here we find that a dollar drop in government spending for the poor leads to about a 20-cent increase, say, in church support for the poor.
Mm-hmm. And one could see, I mean, when we talk about this, the issue of non-citizens, I mean, these are rather identifiable, you know, constituencies, which is one of the parts, you know, I like about your paper. It's a
yes.
nice area where you can go in and focus on the testing, isn't it? You know, we're probably talking, you know, relatively a great deal about Latino communities, right, and Catholic Church probably stepping in here.
Yeah, that's possible. So, and since, you know, I'm focusing just on Presbyterians, you know, a good important question is if we were to go get some data on say, the Catholic Church, although trust me, that data is not really available. I've checked a few times.
Well, you're right there at Notre Dame.
I beg your pardon?
You're right there at Notre Dame. They should just be, you know, handing this out to you,
I guess.
Yeah,
you'd think I'd have the in, but no, unfortunately, the Catholic Church doesn't keep great financial records at the church or diocese level of the sort that I would need for my work.
So what you did this off of was the Presbyterian panel study, right?
That's right, and this is a good lesson for any graduate students out there who are listening. To get this data, I just did some hard work. I called every denomination in the country with at least 1 million members, and I said, do you have any data I could use for a study like this? And the Presbyterian Church, they were the only ones that said yes, and they gave me a data set that had every church in the country, that's 7,000 or 8,000 churches.
Mm-hmm.
Every year from 1994 to 2000, I knew where the church was located, its address, its membership, and I had all sorts of financial information on each church, money going in, money going out, data that's never been used in research before, and they sold it to me for $27.
That's all?
That's all.
Oh, you didn't have to write an NSF grant for $27 now, did you?
No, no. So, it was,
just a car wash.
That $27 data set launched me on my career. So it was the best $27 investment I've ever made.
I just as a side here, I mean, there's a number of interesting lessons, as you mentioned, for graduate students. But I think for the general public here as well is that, you know, they think us scholars have just immediate access to data that we can just pull off, you know, our computers
yeah.
and stuff. But it's not the case. And what is really neat about your work, given that this is a relatively new field that you are plowing here, is that a lot of data isn't available there. But, you know, the footwork that you did on this thing is quite amazing. And, you know, just to call around and say, hey, do you have this stuff? And then to find they're willing to give it to you for $27. Was that the cost of postage?
Mostly.
Okay.
Although I'll tell you that they got us back a few years later. I went back to them and said, I need more data. I'll buy it from you. And they said, okay, name, you know, how much do you think you should pay us for it? And I said, well, that's kind of like asking the fox to run the hen house.
Yeah.
So I consulted with a few folks and said, I'll give you a few $100 for this data. So, you know, I had some success at that point in my career. I could afford a little more than 27, so I paid a few hundred.
Yeah.
And then a few weeks later, I ran into a buddy of mine, a guy named Larry Anacone. Now, has he been on your radio show yet?
He is not. We're trying to get him on, and he's a little bit shy, so we're going to lure him into it. I'm going to be going down to Chapman University in a couple months. And so,
all right. So, you know, he's an important scholar when it comes to American religion.
Right.
And so I'm talking with him, and he mentions that he also got this extra data from the Presbyterian Church.
Uh-huh.
And I say, oh, really? How much did you pay for it? And he said, oh, we got it for free. They told us that there are some dummies who paid a few $100 for it a few months ago, but they just gave it to us and said, I guess I'm the dummy then.
Well, I get you. You study charity, so I would write that off as a charitable contribution, I guess.
There you go. Yeah, well, I did write it off on my taxes, so kidding about that.
Okay. you did the study, and you find out that there's this 20-cent effect to it,
right.
Essentially, when, you know, the church is kind of stepping back in for every one, if I got this correct, for every $1 that the government decreases for welfare provision in some area, the Presbyterian Church is stepping in with 20 cents.
Right.
Okay. I'm interested in that trade-off, too, because we're kind of comparing this apples to apples here. And, you know, I don't know if you have anything to say about this, but is a 20-cent increase in charitable contributions equivalent to a $1 drop in government funding? Now, people might think that's kind of odd. They say, well, there's an 80 cents difference in there. But, I mean, the questions of efficiency seem to come up here quite a bit, because, you know, that $1 that the government provides might be filled with what economists and political economists call deadweight costs, that, you know, for every dollar that the government spends, actually 80 cents of it goes to perhaps, you know, bureaucracy or something of that nature, and only 20% comes out there and gets to the people in need, as compared to religious organizations that might have lower deadweight costs. Do you look into that at all?
So, not in that paper, but absolutely there are some issues beyond just this 20-cent number that you want to think about if you're going to compare what the government's doing to what churches are doing. Issue number one is that there are services for the disadvantaged beyond just churches, okay? So, you know, all sorts of nonprofit organizations out there, the United Way, sponsored organizations, Red Cross, whatever,
mm-hmm.
Also might respond to what the government's doing.
Right.
Lots of other scholars had looked at these nonprofits. No one had ever looked at churches before, so I kind of came along and said, I'm going to add 20 cents to all the other numbers that people have put out there, because everybody's been missing this 20 cents. So the real number is probably higher than the number that I come up with. So that's one thing. A second thing is the quality issue. So a dollar spent by the government might get you something different than a dollar spent by a nonprofit or by a religious group. This kind of gets us back to that Marvin Olasky compassionate conservative sort of argument. I would say there are things on both sides of that issue. You know, in favor of private provision, you have the fact that nonprofit organizations and church organizations, they might face less bureaucracy, they might face less red tape
mm-hmm.
than the government. To the extent that religious organizations want to provide, a more holistic, let's say, a more spiritual aspect to their social service provision, you know, there's a lot of research that suggests that religious participation is beneficial for all sorts of important outcomes. So in that sense, non-government provision could also potentially be more efficient. That's kind of a controversial statement, but it's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, in favor of the government, you have things such as the scope of the government. Getting back to the Great Depression, you know, the government was able to do just a lot more than congregations were able to do.
Right.
And then another advantage of the federal government is that since it's federal and it's everywhere in the country, if you've got a certain part of the country that just gets absolutely hammered by a recession that's maybe very regional specific, maybe a certain industry just goes through the floor or something like that, the federal government with its size is able to take funds away from areas of the country that can afford to provide support and move them to communities and parts of the country that are especially hard hit.
Whereas local churches would have difficulty doing that.
Exactly. And that was, I think, a lesson that was to some extent learned during the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why the federal government played a larger role in the Depression, and that role has not diminished since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that Stephen Mansma and Chris Soper have done some research on this topic of, you know, what is government or religious institutions more efficient at mm-hmm. doing this? And they find, I mean, what you're saying is basically it's a mixed bag. It really depends on a lot of things. So
right.
I think we'll have to get them on the podcast here in a bit. The other thing that I like about the 1996 welfare reform paper is that you not only deal with the issue of institutions or organizations, the entire congregations providing welfare, but you also deal with how individuals, individual donors, charitable donors respond to all this. In particular, you're looking at whether individuals increase or decrease their own private donations to churches when you see this increase in government activity, not only in terms of welfare provision, but taxation. So what's going on here?
That's actually less clear in my paper. So my estimates aren't super precise there, meaning there's a bunch of different stories that I'm kind of unable to rule out with my noisy data.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like as the government scales things back in 96 and churches step in to provide more for the local community, that we do see an increase in donations made by people who are going to church. And donations, of course, are the driving financial force for most churches. Most churches, I don't know if I'd say they live hand to mouth exactly, but you know, donations as opposed to renting out property or things. Donations are the thing that drive most churches.
Right, especially a lot of their mission oriented
sure.
work.
Sure. So it does look like people donate more. My best guess from the numbers I see is that donations don't fund all of it. To some extent, churches are also paying for this increased support by spending a little less on other things. For example, they might spend a little bit less on, maintaining the church.
Mm-hmm.
They might spend a little bit less on payments made to the denominational headquarters. They might spend a little bit less on overseas missions.
Mm-hmm.
So some of this money might come from increased donations, and some of it might come from cutting back a little bit on other things that churches could potentially spend money on.
And that's really a neat story, because what you know, when you talk about this substitution or fungibility of church money and that, what I'm hearing here is that churches at the local level really see this need, and they actually are reacting to it.
Yeah, and I am a numbers crunchers guy, but something I do try to put in most of my papers is anecdotal stuff. So, if you see these responses in the data, you should be able to, put on your detective hat and go out to the community or maybe the local library and find evidence of, congregations talking about this stuff, congregations, taking action.
Mm-hmm.
And, there is evidence that when these federal reforms happened, congregations were taking note of it and were responding to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, that's what they're telling you they're doing, and so you got to admit that this is the case of what they are doing. To kind of extend this a little bit, you do another paper. You talk about the different effect that government policy has on individual charity, and you mentioned two types of giving that I think you categorize them as pure altruism and warm glow. And in terms of talking about how individuals decide to donate or contribute to the local community, to the church, what do we mean here by pure altruism and warm glow giving?
Sure. So in this paper, right, I'm looking again at this crowd out issue, which I've done in a few different papers,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to see whether or not government spending to help the poor, whether its impact on faith-based spending to help the poor might vary in different communities depending on who's living in the community or other things. And the answer depends, as you said, on the incentives people have to give to charity, the reasons people have to give to charity.
Mm-hmm.
One important reason to give to charity might be what we'd call an altruistic incentive, which means I care about, for example, the well-being of the poor, and I want the needs of the poor to be addressed. I don't care how they're addressed. I don't care whether I'm the one doing it or whether it's my neighbor across the street. I don't care at all, but what I really care about is that the needs of the poor are being addressed. I would consider that an altruistic motivation for giving to the poor. But there's an additional potential sort of incentive to give to the poor, And that incentive is one where you don't just care about the needs of the poor, but in particular, you yourself would like to play a role.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, I care about the needs of the poor, but I would prefer that I myself do something to help the poor out. And that sort of incentive, which was first developed famously by an economist named Jim Andreoni, is known as a warm glow incentive.
Mm-hmm.
So, people often think of that as an incentive where you want to provide support for charity so that you get a warm, fuzzy feeling. You know, you get some benefit from doing your part,
right,
so to speak. There are other, frankly, more cynical stories that also kind of fit with a warm glow. For example, you might want to play a role in providing for the poor in your community, partly just because you want to be seen as a great guy. So it's partly just so that you can inflate your own ego.
Mm-hmm.
When we walk into a lot of organizations supported by charity, there's plaques on the wall with lots of names of important donors, and there's fancy paintings of people and stuff.
Right.
The existence of those things suggests that to some extent, when people are providing charitable services, they're not just doing it for purely altruistic reasons, but they get something from seeing their name on the wall, from being able to walk down the street and have everyone go, oh, look, there's such and such, the big philanthropist. He's so great. That sort of self-centered motivation, we would call a warm glow.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the paper that you wrote about this, the paper, and again, if people are getting confused, we'll link all your research papers up on our website here. You've written quite a great deal about this. The paper that we're talking about here is called Diversity and Crowd Out, a theory of cold glow giving. And so you just told us what warm glow is. What is the cold glow giving?
Cold glow means that the warm glow goes away.
Uh-huh.
So, as an example I talk about in my paper, as communities grow more racially diverse, there's lots of research that suggests that people give less to charity. Lots of research that suggests that's true. This is definitely not a feel-good paper, by the way.
Yeah.
But when doing this sort of, kind of cynical work, in this paper I say, okay, we know that when communities get racially diverse, we see less charitable activity. We also see people voting less. We see people, completing their census form less, all sorts of, decreases in kind of civic activities. And I say this decline could be because of a decrease in altruistic motives. So as a community grows more diverse, I just care less about the poor. Or it could be that your warm glow gets cooled off. So as a community grows more diverse, back when I knew everybody in my neighborhood, I really cared about their opinion of me. I really wanted my name on the wall of the charity. I wanted to be known as a really generous donor. But now that the community's diverse, I really don't care what other people think about me. And so my warm glow incentive to support charity is gone away.
Yeah, especially in terms of, if it's the people you're thinking about here, the diverse crowd that you don't have much contact in, one would expect that you don't get much warm glow from them, right?
That's right. And, to a casual person who's hearing about this for the first time, you may think to yourself, well, who cares? Maybe as a community grows more diverse, people care less about the poor. Or maybe as a community grows more diverse, they care less about, this warm glow incentive to look generous. Does the difference even matter? And what I show in the paper is that absolutely this difference in how diversity affects your incentives, whether it affects your incentives through an altruistic incentive or through a warm glow incentive, this difference is critical when it comes to government intervention, when it comes to crowd out, when it comes to the policy implications.
And we had mentioned this a little bit earlier on, so I want you to go into this a little bit more, because I found this to be an absolutely fascinating subtlety to all of your research that, you know, when we're first talking about here before, we said, well, there's government and religion, there's crowd out, push back and forth. But, you know, this paper is telling you that in certain communities, it means different things.
That's right. And so how crowd out's going to work is going to depend upon why people want to give. So you're going to make me earn my keep here for a minute. I'm going to try to explain this as simply as I can, without having to charge anybody tuition for listening here.
Okay, we're all about the free thing here. This is a free lunch service.
Right. So you'll have to put on your thinking cap for a second for this, but it does make some sense. One extreme scenario would be that as a community grows more diverse, the altruistic incentive to give to charity goes away. Everybody says, I don't really care about the well-being of the poor at all. The only reason I'm going to give is because I want to impress my friends.
Right.
Well, in that case, if the government steps in and says, hey, we're going to do more to help the poor in this community, you won't care at all.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because you don't care about the poor in the community. You're just giving to impress your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now let's consider the opposite story. Whereas a community grows more diverse, you don't care about impressing anybody at all anymore. Well, in this case, the only reason you'd have to give, since, you know, you don't care about impressing anybody, the only reason you have to give is because you might care about how the poor are doing in your community. Mm-hmm. In this case, then, when the government steps in to help the poor, you could be very responsive. Mm-hmm. Because the only reason you have to give to the poor is because you care about their well-being. So if the government itself does some sort of intervention to help the well-being in the community, you might be very responsive to that since you're paying so much attention to how the poor are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So in one story, when the government steps in, you don't care. In the other story, when the government steps in, you care a lot. But both stories fit with prior research suggesting that as communities grow very diverse, people give less to charity. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I start the paper. I say we know that when communities get diverse, people give less to charity. But there's two explanations. At first, they sound similar, but when you think it through, they have opposite implications for what's going to happen if the government steps in.
Mm-hmm.
How was that? Was that too?
No, it's really good, and it's a wonderful paper in that regard because it, you know, as you mentioned, earlier too, that it moves beyond simple, you know, assertions that, well, this is just racism, people don't care about this, but it really talks about the, you know, reasons why people give, and I think you make a really, really good first cut at really kind of sorting this warm glow and cold glow giving out and then putting in, you know, the government policy aspect of it. I mean, nobody's done that before, and I think that's what makes this paper just absolutely spectacular in that regard. And I'm sure there's going to have to be a lot more research done on that. So you know, graduate students who want to work for free, give Dan a call. But it is a really, you know, kind of nice thing that comes out from all of your previous research, and I think it's an area that's going to be, a lot of people are going to be looking at here again in the future. In the minutes that we have remaining here, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, that churches are not only in competition with government, which is what we've spent most of the podcast up to this point talking about, but they're in competition with other secular institutions. And you did another paper. The title of it is "The Church Versus the Shopping Mall: What Happens When Churches Face Increased Secular Competition." And this is a neat paper as well, too, that we oftentimes want to think about. You know, what happens when other activities, you know, video games, football games, shopping malls kind of come in. Does that really take away from religiosity? And you go out and test this, and what do you find there?
What we find is that, yeah, absolutely, churches do compete with the shopping mall down the street. We focus on laws that prohibit commerce on Sundays to get at this issue. So those sorts of laws, people call them blue laws, are laws that would prohibit certain retail activities on the Sabbath or usually on Sunday, more specifically. So nowadays, most people think of blue laws as kind of being something that limit, you know, say, alcohol sales, and that might only be found in certain parts of the country, like the Deep South or something.
Right.
But the truth is, if you go back 50 years ago or so, these laws were very common, not so much out west, but for most of the rest of the country they were very common, and they were often very strong in their list of prohibited activities. They would just, for example, prohibit all retail activity or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1960s, there was a Supreme Court decision about the constitutionality of these laws. After that decision, a lot of these laws started to get thrown out in court. And so what we do in our paper is we see when these laws get repealed and suddenly the shopping mall can open on Sunday, whether or not we see people going to the mall more and whether we see people going to church less.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, absolutely, we find that people go to church less. They're less likely to be members of religious groups, and they give less to church. All of those measures of religious participation fall when the shopping mall opens.
So it seems that the, you know, churches who were in many ways advocates of these laws, you know, 100, 200 years ago, were really onto something. They kind of had that intuitive sense that if, you know, the shopping mall is competing with them, they're not going to receive their share of the contributions and attendance.
That's absolutely right. And if you look into the history of these laws, it's interesting. There was absolutely no deception or anything like that when a lot of these laws were first put in place. They were absolutely put in place to stop competition.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, people say, oh, it's for a day of common rest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's important no matter what your religious tradition is, and so on and so forth. Back when a lot of these laws were first put in place, there was nothing about a day, you know, that was not the motivation. They were explicitly religious in their motivation, in many instances, maybe not all, but in many instances.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right. So the people who wrote those laws, they were correct to be worried about that sort of competition.
And you'd see, you know, that in other places in the world today, in a number of Muslim countries, I know most notably Saudi Arabia, they have what we would call blue laws that say, okay, when it's, you know, time for the calls to prayer, that you shut down. That's the time that you do that. So that's still around. I just kind of thought about this as we were talking about this. You know, Sunday mornings, you know, most malls actually open later. And I don't know if this is right. The residual fingerprints of these blue laws, you know, after they start becoming repealed, you know, 50 years later, or, you know, if it's the case that, you know, malls don't open because they know their employees are going to be at church, or they know that, you know, even if there are some people who come to the mall, not enough people are coming to the mall at 9 a.m. on Sunday to make it worthwhile to hire some employees. I don't know. You have any thoughts on that?
That's right. Yeah, I do have some thoughts on that. Yes, in all my years of working on this, yes, I've definitely been asked about that a number of times. That's absolutely true, and it varies in some parts of the country how true it is. For example, I used to live in Durham, North Carolina, back when I was a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that town was very, very quiet on Sunday mornings. Pretty much everything in the world was closed, so much so that some people who lived there thought that there were blue laws in effect there, even in modern times, when in fact the blue laws in Durham are much milder than in a lot of other parts of the country. However, some things are able to open on Sundays. For example, you know, even if the mall's not open, you might have the grocery store being open, the golf course being open,
mm-hmm.
the shopping mall, or the beach or the local park being open. And I would expect with time we're going to see some further erosion of those sorts of cultural prohibitions for stores being open on Sundays. And I would also say, and somebody out on the West Coast such as yourself might appreciate the truth of this, I think that there are some other competitors with the church on Sunday morning, such as football.
Absolutely. I was going to bring that up.
Yeah. Listen, I have always kind of thought of all the competitors across the street for the church in our modern era, I think the NFL ranks as one of the top ones. Its rise as almost an institution
in
modern American life is just amazing.
Yeah, I can tell you firsthand that you know, if the Seattle Seahawks are playing the New York Giants on the East Coast, you know, the game time will start, you know, roughly 9 a.m.
Right.
Pacific time here, and
right.
You know, church attendance is down quite a bit, especially if the Seahawks are doing good. But, you know, churches here over the past few years haven't had anything to fear about that, because we pretty much have said that Seattle has not had a professional football team in several years. But we're getting the Washington Huskies back, and we're going to give Notre Dame a run for their money coming up here. So
I see. Well, you know, since that's on a Saturday, you know, the churches of the Northwest can rest easy.
Okay. But,
you know, and getting back to some issues we brought up right at the beginning of this podcast, you know, you talked about how so much attention in the social sciences on religion is churches competing with each other.
Right.
To me, something like the NFL is a completely unstudied, very important source of competition, let's say, mm-hmm. for religious organizations. And in some of the work I've done, I did a survey where I just asked a bunch of leaders of churches, are you worried about other churches stealing your members? And almost everybody said, no, I'm not that worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, what about, you know, worldly opportunities, leisure opportunities, football, you know, things like that? Are you worried about stuff like that stealing your members? And everybody says yes.
Yeah.
And so, to me, in the social sciences, there's a complete misplaced emphasis on congregations competing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a outdated, you know, idea. And I think the vastly more important idea is stuff like this football thing that we're talking about. And,
yeah.
You know, nobody's studying that at all.
I thought a great deal about that as well. When, you know, when we talk about, and I've been one who's written about this before, when we talk about religious competition, between churches, and I've seen this in Latin America when Protestants have started making inroads and such, but the way I conceive of competition between churches nowadays, and we talk about religious pluralism as being a proxy for religious competition, that word competition always seems to indicate a negative sum game, that, you know, I get a parishioner, which means I take one away from you.
Right.
But I think in that church-to-church competition or pluralism that we see, it's really a positive sum game. And I've talked to a number of pastors as well. They say, you know, it's great having other churches in the neighborhood because I learn from them. Their kids group is doing this, and maybe we should try that. And so that kind of competition has that positive aspect to it. But I think what you are bringing to the fore is that, you know, in terms of the competition having a negative sum arrangement to it, is it's really these secular competitors, the shopping mall, the NFL, and, you know, potentially the government, as we had talked about here. So, you know, your work, I think, is really helping to reconceive a lot of how we understand how churches operate in this large religious marketplace. So I really thank you for doing that work on it, and I wish you the best in continuing it, because I'll be following it quite closely. And I know you've written a bunch of other things, too, that we want to have you back on the podcast at some point in time, but we are out of time right now. So, Dan, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Hey, sure. Thanks for having me. Any graduate students out there, just give me a ring.
Very good. All right, and we'll talk with you folks all next week. Bye now.
All right. Hey, thanks very much, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.